bioavailability to assess contaminated sediment risk. This is passive sampling and poor water remedial goals. We'll be joined by two speakers today. Our first presenter is Rob Burgess, who's joining us from EPA's Office of Research and Development in the National Health and Environmental Effects Research Laboratory. He's a research physical scientist there, where he is working in the Atlantic Ecology Division in Rhode Island. His current research focuses on better understanding the partitioning and bioavailability of organic and metal contaminants in the environment. Specifically, this research is emphasizing the use of passive samplers for measuring the bioavailability of legacy and emerging contaminants. Overall, his research attempts to provide useful and accurate scientific information to regulators and environmental managers for making informed decisions. He has contributed to the authorship of approximately 90 peer-reviewed papers and book chapters, most of which are related to geochemistry, sediment contamination, and aspects of ecological risk assessment. Our second speaker today will be Lawrence Burkhardt, who's also joining us from EPA's Office of Research and Development in their National Health and Environmental Effects Research Laboratory. Lawrence is a research chemist with the Mid-Continent Ecology Division out in ORD in Duluth, Minnesota. He is a graduate of Pennsylvania State University and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His research focuses on the bioaccumulation and effects of persistent bioaccumulative toxicants, or PBTs, and methodologically challenging compounds, or MCCs, in sediments, aquatic organisms, and aquatic food webs. He also looks at analysis and detection of known and unknown toxicants using mass spectrometry instrumentation and also biologically based analytical methods for the detection and identification of unknown toxicants in environmental samples, as well as modeling the bioaccumulation of chemicals in aquatic food webs. So with those brief introductions, I'd like to bring up the presentation content for our first presenter today and again begin our presentation. So we'll start off today with Rob Burgess. So Rob, whenever your presentation content appears, feel free to begin.
Okay, thanks, Jean. Okay, well, good morning or good afternoon, depending where you guys are located. Thanks for being here today. I'm just going to start with a brief outline of what I'll be talking about for the next few minutes. First of all, why use passive sampling methods and what they tell us. Why do we care about the freely dissolved concentration, what I call the C-free, and I'll be mentioning that several times. Types of passive samplers and how they work. Preparing, deploying, recovering, and storing passive samplers. I'll talk briefly about analyzing passive sampler data. And then I'll go through some applications of passive samplers and then wrap it up with a summary. And before I start, I should just mention, and this is true for Lawrence's presentation also, the focus today is on non-ionic organic contaminants, not metals. There are passive samplers for metals, but the technology isn't quite as advanced as it is for organic contaminants. So really what we're talking about today are PCBs, DDTs, PAHs, dioxins, furans. Okay, so the first question is why use passive sampling methods and what they tell us. And passive samplers can tell us basically at least two things. The first thing is the freely dissolved concentration, again what we call the C-free of contaminants of concern in the water around the passive sampler. And what's interesting about this quantity is that it's been shown to be a fairly good surrogate for the bioavailable concentration of our contaminants. And this is true in pore waters or interstitial waters, as well as up in the water column. And the value of the C-free is that we can compare it to water quality criteria values. Lawrence will talk about that. Other water quality standards, sediment guidelines, any sort of water-only toxicity value can be compared to the C-free. The second thing that the passive samplers tell us, or at least the second thing, and it's a little bit obvious, but it's simply the concentration of the contaminants inside the passive samplers. And this is important because there's growing evidence that there's a pretty good correlation between what an organism will bioaccumulate in its lipids and what a passive sampler will accumulate. And so we could see in some instances considering the use of passive samplers as surrogates for biomonitoring organisms. And this could be true of benthic organisms as well as organisms that live in the water column. And we may consider using this approach if we have a situation where deploying mussels or fish in the field would be hazardous to the organisms. It's too cold or too hot, the water is toxic or low DO. None of those factors would affect adversely the passive sampler. Okay, So then we get onto a question of why do we care about the C-free, this freely dissolved concentration? So if we focus on benthic organisms, and that is what we're talking about today, are the sediments for the most part, and we ask the question, what media is an effective surrogate for exposure to bioavailable chemicals for those organisms? Is it the sediment around them? Is it the food they eat? Is it the water column above them? Or is it the pore water? And we know that the freely dissolved concentration of contaminants reside in the pore water. Well, fortunately for us, Adams, back in the 1980s, addressed this question with a really classic study. Others have reproduced this study, so it stood the test of time. And so what he did is he took two sediments and amended them or spiked them with ketone, same level of pesticide, and the pesticide is shown down in the lower corner here. But the organic carbon content was different in the sediments. One had 1.5% organic carbon, and the other one had 12.3% organic carbon. He used the freshwater midge. These were freshwater studies. And the midge is up in the upper right-hand corner. He did flow-through and static studies, 14-day exposures. And he looked at several endpoints, including acute and chronic growth endpoints. Check marks up here. And he also finally looked at exposure-response relationships, survival and growth versus exposure. And exposure is really what we're trying to get at. Is C-free a good measure of exposure for these sediment organisms? So let's look at some of his data. So on the y-axis on this plot, we have midge survival in percent, and the next plot will have the same setup. And on the x-axis, thank you, on the x-axis, we have the sediment concentration in milligrams ketone per kilogram dry sediment. So let's take a look at the first sediment dose response curve. So this is the sediment that had 1.5% organic carbon. Here's the dose response curve for that. And now we'll take a look at the second dose response curve. This is the sediment that had 12.3% organic carbon. So now if we ask the question, what media is an effective surrogate for exposure to bioavailable chemicals? Well, we're looking at the data right now presented as sediment concentrations on the x-axis. But what we have to remember with these, we have two sediments, but they have exactly the same amount of ketone in each sediment. If the sediment was a good measure of bioavailability, the dose response curves would be identical, but instead we get very different dose response curves when we look at sediment concentrations, total sediment concentrations. So Bill concluded, no, that doesn't work. He also looked at the food, that didn't work. Also looked at the water column, that didn't work. But then he said, how about we take a look at the pore water concentration in these ketone amended sediments? So again, we have on the y-axis, midge survival in percent, but now on the x-axis, we have pore water concentration as microgram ketone per liter pore water. So let's take a look at the first dose response curve he generated. This is for the 1.5% organic carbon sediment. And here's the second curve for the 12.3% organic carbon sediment. And from a toxicological perspective, these curves are identical. So again, getting back to the fundamental question, what media is an effective surrogate for exposure to bioavailable chemicals? Again, found sediments didn't work. Food didn't work, water column didn't work, and granted, these are water column organisms, so we wouldn't expect it to work too well. But when he looked at pore water as a way of representing bioavailability, and we know that in pore water, we have the freely dissolved concentration, he found a good connection between bioavailability and pore water concentration and C-free. So this leads to a question of measuring the freely dissolved concentration in pore waters as well as in the water column. We do have conventional techniques for measuring pore water concentrations, and really I should say extracting, isolating, and then measuring pore water concentrations of contaminants. We've had these methods for decades, but there are some problems with them. With the pore water, we generally centrifuge or squeeze the pore water squeeze the sediment to get the pore water to come out. But generally, we end up with fairly limited volumes of actual pore water. And then there are all sorts of artifacts that can come into play. We have losses to filters, losses to glassware or laboratory-ware surfaces. And then on the other hand, we have contamination by colloids and small particles, all of which reduce the accuracy of our chemical analyses and toxicological analyses for that matter. And also, collecting large volumes of pore water is challenging. It's a little bit scientifically dodgy, and it can be quite expensive. Not that we're focusing on the water column today, but just to talk about that briefly, there are also some problems with measuring water column concentrations of C3 using conventional techniques. It's logistically and technically difficult to collect and extract large volumes of surface water. We run into the same artifacts that we had with the pore water collection, sources of loss, as well as sources of contamination. And also, analytical detection limits are often just not low enough for surface waters, even at some of the Superfund sites. So this, of course, leads to another question. Is there some other sampling method for measuring the C3 concentration of contaminants other than our conventional methods? And it's probably not much of a spoiler that the answer is passive sampling. But before we go there, let's just go to a piece of the environment here and take a closer look at what's going on in the sediments. So we have the atmosphere, we have our water column, we have our contaminated sediments. And if we just blow up a section of those sediments, we can see we have our sediment particles, we have our pore water or interstitial water, and we have our PCB molecules, and I'm presenting them as these yellow guys here. And we know that we have our freely dissolved concentration, our C3 that Adam's work showed was so important at understanding the bioavailable concentration of contaminants. Now we know over time through diffusion, advection, as well as trophic transfer, these contaminants in the sediments are going to make their way into the benthos, into the fish, into the mussels, into the wildlife, and potentially into humans as well. But let's again take a closer look at what's going on in the sediments. So we're just going to blow up the chunk of the bottom again and now magnify it a bit. So again, we have our pore waters in this particular cartoon. We have our sediment particles, pore water, sediment particles. We have PCBs associated with the sediment particles. And again, we have our C3 in the truly freely dissolved chemical in the pore waters. Now, we operate under the belief that sediment systems are at equilibrium or at least approaching equilibrium. And under those conditions, we can invoke equilibrium partitioning and generate some partition coefficients that help us get to C3 and other important information. So one basic partition coefficient that we all use on some basis is the KD. And that's simply the concentration of the contaminant on the particle divided by the C3 concentration. If we organic carbon normalize the concentration in the sediments, and this is what Adam's work was doing, he was playing around with the organic carbon content of those sediments, we generate the organic carbon normalized partition coefficient, or what we call the KOC. Now we know over time that in an equilibrium system we're going to lose some of these PCBs, and we show that in the early illustration through advection and diffusion. Some of these PCBs will make their way out of the sediment and go up into the pore water or someplace else. But if we're at equilibrium, any molecule that is lost will be replaced by one of the molecules that's on the sediment surface, or really in the sediment organic carbon through desorption, and will maintain equilibrium conditions. And even if we introduce a nasty-looking worm, like I just hopefully put up on the screen, it has lipids, it's going to absorb PCBs, but as those PCBs are absorbed by the organism, they'll be replaced in the pore water through equilibrium partitioning. And we can generate a bioconcentration factor, a BCF, that's the biota concentration divided by the C3 concentration. And now if we replace the organism, and it's fairly analogous to do this, we can introduce our passive sampler. And this is, yes, my representation of a passive sampler. It's not an eraser, it's not a TARDIS, it is a passive sampler, and you'll see it again and again throughout the presentation. And just like the organism, it's going to absorb chemicals from the pore water, and those chemicals will be replaced. And we get from this one more partition coefficient, which is our K sampler, or our K passive sampler partition coefficient. And it's the concentration in the sampler divided by the C-free, just like the organism, but we replace the organism lipids with the sampler concentration. Now, if we ask ourselves, for your average contaminated sediment out there in the world, how does its pore water C-free behave over time? Here's an illustration of that. So we have freely dissolved concentration on the y-axis. This is the pore water concentration in C-free, nanograms per liter on the y-axis. We have time and days on the x-axis, and again, we'll be looking at a hypothetical PCB. Now, if we could measure instantaneously the actual C-free concentration, we might see something like this. Now, technically, we can't. We can't measure C-free instantaneously. But if we could, we might see something like this. Concentration is fairly constant over time because it's an equilibrium system in those pore waters. Maybe have an event like this where we have a resuspension and overlying water is introduced into the sediment. It temporarily dilutes the C-free concentration, but because it is an equilibrium system, the concentration comes back over time and we return to this stable concentration that we see here. Now with our passive samplers, what we're trying to do is we introduce a passive sampler to a system. Initially, it's very clean. And as time goes by, it tracks this actual C-free concentration until we arrive at a time-averaged or time-integrated measurement of the C-free concentration. And that's the entire goal of passive sampling, is to track the actual C-free concentration in the pore waters. So if we return to our contaminated environment where we're trying to figure out the C-free concentration so we have a better handle on how organisms and the environment itself will be contaminated, what we're thinking about doing now with passive sampling is still focusing on, obviously, on the dissolved and bioavailable concentration, but now we'll use passive samplers in the water column and also in the sediment to measure that C-free concentration. Okay, so that was a bunch of background on kind of hypothetically how passive sampling works and the goal of getting at a C-free concentration. Next, I was just going to go through some of the actual passive samplers that are used in North America for making those C-free measurements. Currently in North America, there are about four passive samplers that get used the most. The first one is on the left-hand side here. That is polyethylene. This is that very simple plastic, plastic bags for sandwiches and trash bags are made of. We actually use the drop cloth that you would buy at a hardware store to put down on the floor if you're painting a room and you don't want any paint to get onto the floor. That's our passive sampler, so it's nothing fancy, and it's very inexpensive, so it makes for a great passive sampling material. The thinner a passive sampler is, the faster the contaminants equilibrate with it. So thinner passive samplers are better. You can buy polyethylene now about down to 25, even 12 microns in thickness, and then up to 50 or 75 microns. On the right-hand side of the screen, we have another film or sheet-type passive sampler. That's polyoxymethylene or POM. This material is a denser, harder type of plastic. It reminds me of the old acetates we used to use for overhead projectors. You can buy it commercially at thicknesses of 75 as well as, I believe now, 25 or 35 microns thick. The third passive sampler that's used in North America quite a bit, and this one's on the left-hand side, is solid phase microextraction, or SPINI. And they're these little tiny fibers. So they take another cartoon to illustrate how they work. And these fibers are actually fiber optic cable that the telecommunication industry uses. So inside the fiber, we actually do have a glass core that the telecommunication people are interested in. But it's insulated on the outside by a polymer, polydimethyl siloxane, PDMS, that actually has a fairly high affinity for organic contaminants. You can get thicknesses of 10 to 100 microns with SPINI fibers. The final type of passive sampler that's used in North America is semipermeable membrane devices, SPMDs. And you may have heard of these. This is probably the first type of passive sampler used around here. It is also made of polyethylene, but it's a polyethylene tube. And what is done is you heat seal one end of the tube, Then you add a layer of Triolein, which is a synthetic lipid, and then you heat seal the other end, and you end up with this plastic kind of sausage that you can deploy in the environment. The thickness of the polyethylene in SPMDs ranges from 50 to, say, 95 microns. The thing about SPMDs is we don't really use them in sediments. If they rip open, and they can rip open during a deployment, you lose the Triolein, and then it makes it very difficult to interpret your data. So we won't be talking about SPMDs anymore. In this slide, I just wanted to show you the chemical structure. Unfortunately, it looks like the slide got a little messed up. But the point is, we have the three chemical structures of the polyethylene, the polyoxymethylene, and PDMS. And they are all basically hydrocarbons, made up of carbons and hydrogen. Certainly, there's some oxygen in the POM, and there's silicone and oxygen in the PDMS. And there's a key over here on the right-hand side for what each of the colors means in terms of an atom. But the basic structure is hydrocarbon. When we introduce a kind of large PCB molecule, for comparison's sake, we can also see that the PCB is a hydrocarbon. It's made up of carbon, hydrogen. It certainly has these chlorines, but it is predominantly made up of carbons and hydrogens. And we get into that old chemistry expression, like dissolves like. So what happens in the environment is when we introduce our passive sampler into the system, the PCB, in this case, actually dissolves into the polymer. And the thing to keep in mind is that the PCB really does not want to be in the aqueous phase, in the water phase. The water is a very polar liquid, and the PCB has very little affinity for that because it's a very nonpolar hydrocarbon. So it prefers to be associated with the polymers that we use as passive samplers, which is why they work. All right. I wanted to go through a cartoon just illustrating how passive samplers work when they're deployed in the environment. So we'll start with a chunk of pore water right here. We'll introduce our PCB molecules, again, these yellow guys. These are in the C-free form. Now we'll throw in our passive sampler, which is, this could be a PE, it could be POM, it could be SPME. They all behave the same way. One key point is that they we've cleaned the passive sampler before deploying it, so it's a very clean polymer before we introduce it into the environment. Now, as soon as you introduce the passive sampler into the environment, the PCBs are going to, the target PCBs, are going to try and establish equilibrium with that passive sampler. And so they accumulate in the passive sampler, as just shown. We can look at this in a more graphic way, switching over to a plot. So concentration on the, in this case, nanogram per gram passive sampler on the y-axis. We have deployment time in days on the x-axis. And what's being shown on the screen now is one passive sampler, as it travels through time, accumulating PCBs. And hopefully you can see those little yellow PCBs accumulate as we go from left over to right. And we can convert this over to an uptake curve. Looks like this. And at some point in this uptake process, we're going to reach equilibrium. And what that means is that the amount of contaminant going into the passive sampler is equivalent to the amount of contaminant that is coming out of the passive sampler. So there's no net change in concentration. We are at equilibrium. When we reach equilibrium, we can then invoke a relatively straightforward equation right here for calculating the C-free that we were talking about a few minutes ago. And it consists of the C-sampler, which is the concentration in the passive sampler. And that's what your chemistry or your analytical or your commercial laboratory will provide for you, divided by that partition coefficient we looked at a few minutes ago as well, the passive sampler partition coefficient. And I'll talk about this analysis a little later and give you a little bit more information about it. The key here, though, is that we're equilibrium sampling. We're relying on the sampler and the contaminants to achieve equilibrium in the system. And once we can do that, we can calculate our C-free. Just going to take a quick tangent here just to give you a sense of how popular passive sampling has been in scientific literature the last almost 20 years now. So we have number of publications on the y-axis, and we have year on the x-axis. We're looking at the three most common polymers for passive sampling in North America anyway, and into in Europe as well, in other parts of the world as well. And what we can see, especially about the time of 2008 to the present, there's been quite a few studies with passive sampling. And the different passive samplers are fairly equally represented, except in the last couple of years, POM, polyoxymethylene, we're seeing less and less in use of that type of passive sampler, and it's really coming down to polyethylene and PDMS or SPME as the dominant passive samplers. I said I wasn't going to do this. We weren't going to talk about metal passive sampling, but just for comparison's sake, there is a metal passive sampling technique called DGT, and I'll just, the purple data here shows you the number of publications where DGT has been used, just to give you a sense of its popularity. And you can see that there has been quite a bit of work in the scientific literature on metal passive sampling. This slide shows us the list of 26 Superfund sites from around the country that have used passive sampling at their sites. So passive sampling is gaining more and more momentum for use at Superfund sites to answer various questions. This check mark I just put here is actually incorrect. It should be up at the Palos Verdes shelf site. I'll show you some data from that site in just a moment. Now we'll talk briefly about preparing, deploying, recovering, and storing passive samplers. One point I'd like to really get across is that even though passive sampling is somewhat new, there's nothing very fancy about it. If a commercial or an analytical laboratory can analyze sediments or tissues, they can analyze passive samplers. And passive samplers in some cases will actually be a cleaner, easier sample for them to analyze because the samplers don't tend to get as dirty as sediments or tissues can be. So just to go through the process of the preparation and so on. So we start with a passive sampler. In this case, it could be PE or POM. We then clean it. You have to make sure it's clean before the deployment. That takes 24 to 48 hours. Then we move on to the actual deployment, and generally 30 days or more is recommended for that. And then after the recovery of the passive sampler, it can be wrapped up in clean foil, aluminum foil or some sort of metallic foil, and then stored at negative 4 degrees C in the refrigerator or freezer, really, until you're ready to analyze it. The analysis involves solvent extraction, again, at least 48 hours, volume reduction, and then for most of the contaminants we're talking about right now, PCBs, PAHs, dioxins, and so on, you'd probably be doing some sort of GC mass spec analysis followed by data interpretation to generate the concentration of contaminants associated with the passive sampler. In the next few slides, we'll look at some actual photographs of passive samplers in the environment or what they would look like when they're deployed, just to give you a sense of what these things actually look like when they're being used. So on the left-hand side, we have a system that we developed at our laboratory in Narragansett to compare different types of passive samplers. So we have PE and POM. We put them into a fish trap. And we also had SPME. And remember, the SPME fibers are really small, can be a little bit fragile. So generally, when you deploy them, you have them in some sort of protective covering. We used a copper mesh. We made little envelopes. And we would put the SPME fibers in that for the deployment. That's what's shown here. Another system, which is shown on the right-hand side, is developed at MIT, and they basically just took a passive sampler and put it onto a stainless steel ring, and this can then be deployed out in the environment. And I should take a step back. This is all for water column deployments, just to give you a sense of what those look like. So here's a cartoon of each of those things, each of those types of deployments. So here's that stainless steel ring. Here's the fish trap system we've used. And here's another system that uses a copper tube that has the SPME fiber inside of it, and then the copper tubing, of course, has holes in it, and this can be deployed up in the water column. Another version of this is shown right here, and what we'll be looking at now are passive sampler deployment systems for pore water deployment. So we have our copper tube that I was just showing you in that cartoon. We have the SPME fibers are put into that copper tube with this stainless steel mesh, and then that's put inside this other protective copper tube, and this can be put up in the water column like I showed you just a moment ago, or it can be actually pushed into the sediments. In the middle, we have, and I should say this was a system developed by Squirt in Southern California. In the middle image is very similar to the Squirt system. This is another SPEMI-based system where the SPEMI is inside this copper housing, and this was a system developed by colleagues in Denmark. Finally, on the right-hand side, we have a system that Danny Reibel developed at Texas Tech University, where you have a stainless steel tube that has ports along its length. And it's really hard to see it, but there's a SPEMI fiber that runs the entire length of this tube, and this allows you to get a depth profile of your contaminant. Another type of system that's used for sediment deployment is to take either a sheet of POM or PE, put it between two aluminum frames or stainless steel frames, bolt them together, and then this system can be pushed right into the sediment. And again, you can develop depth profiles for the contaminants. And finally, here's a system that Upal Ghosh at University of Maryland, Baltimore County developed. He was using POM. And what he has here is wire mesh that has the POM inside of it. And this was then attached to a brick that could be rested on the bottom of a stream in this case. And you get a sort of a sediment water column interface measurement. And finally, here's another cartoon just showing what these samplers would look like when they're actually deployed. And one thing I wanted to mention is that both Osrati's dive team as well as the Region 10's dive team have a great deal of experience at deploying recovering passive samplers from contaminated sediment sites. So if you're considering using passive samplers at a site, you may want to contact these groups to see if they could help you out. This is the system we used at Palos Verdes, and I'm going to show you some data from this a little later, but just to show you what the setup was. So we had SPEMI in copper tubing attached to this rig. We also had PE and POM in the frames that I mentioned a moment ago. And we, for this was kind of a research study. We were comparing how the different passive samplers compared to one another in terms of their performance. I wanted to talk about analyzing passive sampler data, and we touched on this a little earlier, but just to cover it in a little bit more detail. So again, the analytical laboratory or commercial laboratory that analyzes your passive samplers will generate raw data. They'll be measuring the C sampler concentration, the concentration of contaminant that's in the sampler after the deployment. Generally, the data will be in nanograms per gram sampler, but occasionally it'll be in nanograms per mil sampler, and that's easily converted back to nanograms per gram by just knowing the density of the polyethylene, which is well understood. The other variable is the partition coefficient, and we talked about that. This is the partition coefficient for the passive sampler for the contaminants of interest. Values for partition coefficients for passive samplers are available in scientific literature for a range of contaminants, as well as we have some EPA documents we've been producing the last several years that have tabulations of partition coefficients for PCBs, PAHs, dioxins, and a handful of other contaminants. So the two types of data you need are the C sampler, and your laboratory will provide that, and then your partition coefficient, and that can be this information can be gotten from the literature or from some EPA documents. And when you have those two pieces of information, you can calculate your C-free. Now, one thing I need to go into a little bit regarding equilibrium is determining when equilibrium actually occurs between the contaminant and the passive samplers can be, in some cases, challenging. And determining when equilibrium occurs for any type of monitoring can be challenging. If you think about when you deploy organisms in the field, when you recover them, are you sure that the contaminants in the organisms have achieved equilibrium? Often we don't know. There are some methods with regard to passive samplers for determining equilibrium. They involve doing time series studies where you would deploy multiple passive samplers and recover them at different time intervals. And when you started to see a lack of a change in concentration of your contaminants of concern over time, you could conclude, yes, we're at equilibrium. Another way is to deploy multiple passive samplers with different thicknesses. And when you look at your data, if you found on a mass basis that there was no difference between different thicknesses of passive samplers in terms of the concentration of contaminant, again, you could conclude that you've achieved equilibrium. The problem with these approaches, they're very time-consuming, more field work, and they involve analyzing a lot more samples. So, of course, this all means it becomes a lot more expensive to use these techniques. Another approach that has been used and adopted, really, by the passive sampling community is the use of performance reference compounds, or PRCs. These are compounds that are loaded into your passive sampler before you do the deployment. They're loaded in the laboratory. And the PRC is a chemical that behaves like your target contaminant of concern. So let me just illustrate with another cartoon how this works. So again, we have our pore water up here. We have our passive sampler. But now we've loaded the passive sampler with our PRCs, these red molecules. Often you can use C13 labeled PCBs as your PRCs. They make very good PRCs for looking at passive sampling with PCBs. We know the initial concentration of our C13 labeled PCBs in the passive samplers. And now we introduce our target PCBs. These are the ones that we're trying to get a better idea of what their C-free concentration is. And just as we saw earlier when we were just looking at the target contaminants by themselves, once you introduce the passive sampler into the system, the target contaminants establish equilibrium with the passive sampler. But simultaneously, the PRCs are establishing equilibrium with the environment around them, too. So they're leaving the passive sampler while the target contaminants, target PCBs, are entering the passive sampler. We can look at this graphically again. Concentration in the passive sampler on the y-axis, deployment time on the x-axis. And we'll just look at one passive sampler as time goes by. And hopefully what you can see is that as time goes by, the PRC concentration, the red PCBs, decrease, whereas the target PCBs, the yellow ones, increase. And we can look at this as an uptake and release curve, where we have the uptake of our target contaminants and then release of the PRCs. And without getting into this in a lot of detail, the magnitude of the difference between the target PCB concentration and the PRC concentration after the recovery gives us information that we can use to determine the magnitude of adjustment for non-equilibrium conditions. What we do with that data, the PRC data, and at this point there's really three different methods for looking at PRC data, and I'll just look at the most, just for illustrating purposes, I'll show you the most simple approach right now. It's called the first order method. It has two steps to it. The first step is using the PRC data, we need to calculate an exchange rate coefficient, the KE, and that's what's calculated here. Again, using the initial PRC concentration, the final PRC concentration, and the time of the deployment. The next step is we go back to our basic C-free calculation, or equation, I should say. But now we add on this extra term that has the exchange rate coefficient in it. And using this calculation, we can get an adjusted for non-equilibrium condition C-free value for our contaminants of interest. So as I said, the first order method is the most basic method that's available, and it was the first one that was developed for analyzing PRC data. Since then, a couple other methods have come forward that are more sophisticated. The first is a diffusion-based method. This looks at the rate of PRC diffusion through the polymer, and that's used to determine the magnitude of disequilibrium correction for the target contaminants. The other method is the exchange rate-based method, and it uses PRC data. It's used to calculate the disequilibrium-corrected exchange rates for the target contaminants. I won't go through any examples with these methods because they are both very calculation-intensive, but fortunately, both of these methods are available on computer-based GUIs or graphical user interfaces or spreadsheets. The GUIs are available at the Superfund website, as well as also at the DOD's CERIP and ESTP website. So we have tools for analyzing PRC data using GUIs as well as spreadsheets. Okay, finally, as I begin to wrap up, I just wanted to talk for a moment about different applications for passive samplers. We've gone through how they work and how to get C-free based on passive sampler deployments, but what would you actually do with these passive samplers? So one question is measuring contaminant of concern bioavailability. And this gets into the idea of using the passive sampler as a surrogate for organism bioaccumulation, and that's something I touched on early on. So we can ask the question, is a passive sampler equivalent to, say, blue mussels that you might deploy, or benthic worms that you might deploy in the laboratory? And that's the type of bioavailability assessments we're talking about. You know, laboratory assessments where you might have a polychaete and some sediment, you could introduce a passive sampler and see how they compare to one another. Or in the field, you might have mussels deployed, co-deployed with your passive sampler, and again, determine how they compare to one another. Well, to answer this question, I was going to just go through some data from the scientific literature from Superfund sites. So the first example, this is data from the New Bedford Harbor Superfund site. This is a laboratory deployment. On the y-axis, we have the concentration of PCBs, and New Bedford is a PCB contaminated site. We have the concentration of PCBs that accumulated in a benthic worm under laboratory conditions. And then on the x-axis, we have the concentration that accumulated in the passive sampler. What we see, we get a really good one-to-one relationship and also very good R-square value of 0.88, so also a lot of statistical robustness, indicating that the passive sampler did seem to be a pretty good surrogate for uptake by the worm. In another study at New Bedford Harbor, this was a field study where we deployed mussels. That data is on the y-axis. Polyethylene data is on the x-axis again. Again, we get a good linear relationship in terms of the concentration taken up by the passive sampler relative to what the mussels were taking up. Pretty good statistics as well, R-squared 0.72. And finally, just want to mention that we did a review a couple years ago, where we looked at all PCB studies where people compared concentrations in organisms versus concentrations in passive samplers where there had been co-deployment of both passive sampler and the organisms either under laboratory or field conditions. What is shown on this plot is the gray zone is basically the one-to-one relationship plus or minus a factor of 10. And all the regression relationships we saw for the studies are presented in this figure. And what we find is that most of the regression equations are linear, and most of them fit within that one-to-one zone plus or minus a factor of 10, suggesting that, again, the passive samplers were serving as pretty good surrogates for the organisms. There were some outliers, but we think we understand what was going on in those studies that resulted in the outlying behavior. And this was done, this review consisted of freshwater oligochaete data, mussel data, polychaete data, gastropods, clams, as well as freshwater mixtures. So we concluded based on this analysis that, yes, the passive sampler does give useful estimates of bioaccumulation when used properly. Another application of passive sampling that's gaining usage is to determine contaminant flux out of the sediments into the water column. So using passive samplers to measure transport of contaminant between sediments and the water column. So what we have here on the y-axis in this image is a depth profile, with the water column is the blue, sediment pool water is the gray area here. And what we know occurs over time, and we talked about this a little while ago, is that the PCBs transfer from the sediments through diffusion, advection, and other mechanisms up into the water column. And you may want to know the magnitude of that transfer. Another application is over here on the right-hand side. Again, we have the same setup, water column, sediments, but now we have a cap in place. And we know we have our PCB molecules are going to be trying to get through that cap. And so something we could consider using the passive sampler for is to look at how well the cap is working at keeping the PCBs in the sediments and not allowing them to transfer into the water column. A way we could do that is illustrated here, starting on the left-hand side. We take one of our frames that I showed you earlier with polyethylene, bring it out to the site. Deploy the frame in the sediment with half of it in the sediment and half the passive sampler up in the water column, so you're getting a sediment exposure at the same time as you're getting a water column exposure. Recover the passive sampler, take it back to the laboratory, and simply cut the passive sampler into vertical slices so that you can develop a depth profile. And then each of those slices is extracted and analyzed separately using the GC mass spec. This is what we did at Palos Verdes, so let me just show you some data that resulted from that. This is the system when it was deployed on the bottom. And so Fernandez in 2014 was able to look at depth as well as the concentration, and that's on the y-axis. On the x-axis, we have the C3 concentration. Palos Verdes is a DVT and PCB site, so we are focused on DDE right now for this plot. And what we're able to look at is the water column concentration based on what was in the passive sampler up in the water column portion, and then the C3 concentration in the sediment pore waters based on the part of the passive sampler that was in the sediment. And based on this difference between water column and sediment concentration, Fernandez was able to calculate a flux of 260 nanograms of DDE per centimeter squared per year. And this approach using passive sampler for looking at fluxes has been used at several sites so far: Palos Verdes, Lower Duwamish in Region 10, Grass River in Region 2, and Dover Gaslight in Region 3. Okay, the final application that I'll talk about, and this is what Lawrence is going to talk about in a lot of detail, is the use of passive sampling for developing pore water remedial goals, or PWRGs. As Lawrence will describe, these are values intended to protect organisms living in or on sediments. They consist of two basic elements. The first is a method for measuring or inferring the freely dissolved concentration of C3 of contaminants in pore water, and hopefully by now that sounds like a familiar goal. The other part of the remedial goal is a threshold chemical concentration that delineates toxicity. The basic quantitative form of the PWRGs is the equation at the bottom here, where we have the C3 concentration divided by that threshold. And again, that C3 is a value that we generate using passive sampling. So in summary, talked about passive sampling and the type of data it provides, the freely dissolved concentration, the C3, as well as the concentration in the passive sampler. Emphasized that the approach operates based on well-understood principles of equilibrium partitioning and sampling. The preparation, deployment, recovery, and so on of passive samplers is really nothing different than the methods used for analyzing tissues or sediments, and maybe possibly of greater scientific robustness, logistically simpler and more cost-effective. And I went through some examples of how passive sampling can be applied at contaminated sites. And finally, for my last slide, I just wanted to mention several useful documents that have been generated over the last several years on passive sampling. The web locations for them are listed here. They include an EPA document that we published a few years ago introducing passive sampling. That's contaminated sites, a document on the usefulness of C3. The SeaTac organization held a workshop on passive sampling back in 2012, and in 2014 published several introductory papers on passive sampling that can be useful. Last year, we published a laboratory field and analytical procedures guide for passive sampling that may be useful to people. And then finally, we have the document that Lawrence generated last year on the remedial goals. And I think with that, I'll thank you for your attention and answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so very much, Rob. We did have a few questions that came in. Just to remind the audience that you can continue to send in your questions and comments using the Q&A box in the lower right corner of your screen. Let me start with this first one, which is actually referencing slide number 4. This participant asks, the dose response curve for sediment, which was shown on slide 4, shows different curves based on organic carbon content. Why not normalize it to OC? Would that show a similar dose response relationship?
Yeah, no, that's a good thing to catch. Yeah, if you normalize by the organic carbon concentration, presumably, and I'm pretty sure Bill Adams did this, presumably those curves would grow or move closer to one another and look more like what the pore water concentration dose response curves look like. But for the purpose of this illustration, I just wanted to really cut to the chase of showing the C-free concentration and the importance of how those two dose response curves were essentially identical.
Okay, thank you. Another participant would like to know, how does C-free vary between sediment deployment versus water column deployment?
That's a good question. Well, you know, I had that slide in there that showed, you know, kind of hypothetically what the C-free concentration would look like in a sediment over time. And, you know, given that many of our most contaminated sites are in low-energy systems, they are likely to achieve equilibrium between the contaminants and the pore water concentrations. And that would suggest, except for events like resuspension events or having large ships go through an area and stir things up or something, you know, that results in large-scale mixing of the system, we would probably expect that the sediment concentrations are going to be fairly constant over time. And another source of deviation from a constant concentration might be groundwater intrusion that may dilute pore water concentration. In contrast, the water column, I guess it would depend. You know, if the sediment is acting as the source of contamination in the water column, we might expect that the water column concentration be relatively constant, taking into consideration other sources of dilution that may occur. You know, in a tidal situation, we might expect at low tide that the water column concentration would be a bit higher than at high tide when you have a lot more water present that could be diluting the water column concentration. Or if you had active streams or rivers coming in, introducing cleaner water, we might expect more variability in the water column concentration. But I think the key point is that in sediment, under equilibrium or near equilibrium conditions in these low energy systems, we would expect that the interstitial water concentration would stay fairly, I don't want to say constant, but fairly stable.
Okay, thank you. Someone wants to know, are there any available test results for ammonia?
Ammonia with passive sampling. I am not familiar with any work looking at passive sampling using ammonia. Ammonia, though, given that it's relatively easy or simple to measure with various kits or probes, and its concentrations are relatively high, there may not be much development work for passive sampling for ammonia. You know, one thing I didn't emphasize, but let me emphasize it now, is another thing that passive samplers do that is really useful is as time goes by, as you approach equilibrium, the contaminants are concentrating in the passive sampler. And the benefit of that is that analytically, as that concentration is occurring, analytically we're able to detect those PCBs or whatever the contaminant is, whatever the organic contaminant is. We're more easily able to detect those contaminants analytically. With something like ammonia, I think in a lot of cases the probes that are out there are pretty sensitive, and it's probably not necessary to do a concentration step like a passive sampler does when you can either in pore waters or even in the water column sometimes measure ammonia concentrations just with a probe directly.
Great, thank you. Someone would like to know, how is particle size accounted for in your pore water testing?
Particle size. I guess I'm not certain I understand the question, except to say that If we focus on the sediments that tend to be the most contaminated, again, they tend to be low energy systems, so we tend to have fairly small particles settling. And really what we become more concerned with, rather than particle size, at least for the C3 concentration, are variables like the amount of organic carbon in the sediment, or for certain contaminants like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and some of the planar PCBs and dioxins and furans, we become concerned with black carbon concentrations in terms of how they may control the C3 concentration. But, you know, for larger particle sizes, if we're thinking about larger particle sizes like sands and particles of that size, I think we generally don't necessarily have a lot of contamination, and I realize that's kind of a generic statement. I think we tend to focus on the low-energy systems that have really small particles and which allow contaminants to accumulate over time.
All right, great. Thank you so much. We do have a few more questions in the queue for you, but I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and move on to our next presentation, and then if time permits, we'll circle back later on, Rob, with these outstanding questions.
Great.
So I want to pass along the thanks. A number of people just chimed in and said thanks very much for that talk. And with that, we'll go ahead and, again, remind everybody we're moving on to our next presentation. So, Lawrence, you should be on the phone line. Feel free to unmute. And whenever you're ready, please go ahead and begin.
I want to thank Rob for kind of setting this particular portion of the presentation up. I'm going to be talking about development of pore water for Bebido goals. And what I'm talking about is in this recently published EPA guidance document on how to do this for protection of benthos. Now, as background or introduction, Superfund requested this guidance some time ago, and there's a lot of stakeholders who think that incorporating bioavailability into remedial goals would be something that would help the remediation process. And as Rob was indicating, passive sampling techniques are now available for assessing bioavailability. And the general consensus is that using bioavailability, we might be able to have less aggressive remedial designs, lower remedial costs, maybe quicker completion of remedial actions. That's kind of the thinking behind all this. As Rob indicated, the methodology that we published in October last year is applicable for the protection of benthic organisms from direct toxicity to sediment contaminants. It's applicable to nonpolar organic chemicals, pH, chlorinated benzenes, pesticides, so and on and on. Just to clarify, the methodology is not applicable to chemicals that would bioaccumulate up, or effects that would be due to bioaccumulation in the food chain to higher trophic levels of benthic species like carp, crab, those kinds of things, pelagic species. And as Rob was indicating, it's not applicable yet to cationic metals or polar organics. The samplers for these two types of classes of chemicals are in a different stage, and we don't have methodologies for them. But in concept, the methodology should work once we have the passive samplers. So a little background. I think everyone on the line here recognizes the need for some type of thresholds for contaminants and sediments that define acceptable and unacceptable risk. As kind of history, prior to 2000, we had some approaches, and basically they ignored bioavailability entirely. They were purely empirical, and that's not so good, maybe. And we know now that factors influencing sediment toxicity are for metals, sulfide concentrations, and for organic carbon. With that thinking, in the 2000s, EPA developed something called equilibrium partitioning sediment benchmarks. And these are based upon EQP theory. And EQP theory, equilibrium partitioning theory, asserts the following points. All phases in a sediment are in equilibrium with each other. So pore water is in equilibrium with the colloids in the pore water. It's in equilibrium with the bulk solids in the sediment. Secondly, it asserts that bioavailability is directly proportional to chemical's activity. Chemical activity is the same in all phases because you're at equilibrium, and C3 in pore water is a good estimate of chemical activity. And further, we say that the bioavailable chemical is equal to the C3 in pore water. With that thinking, in the 2000s, EPA developed equilibrium sediment benchmarks for a number of chemicals based upon concentrations in sediments. And at the time, methods for measuring concentrations in pore water were not available. Passive sampling hadn't been developed, and as Rob indicated, squeezing sediments or spinning sediments down with centrifugation did not provide really adequate numerical values for concentrations in pore water. Equilibrium sediment benchmarks are the same for all sites, and they're based upon concentration in sediment on an organic carbon basis. And so what you do at your site, if you're going to apply these, you would adjust for site-specific organic carbon content. So the equilibrium partitioning sediment benchmarks are simply the product of the organic carbon partition coefficient times the final chronic value for the chemical of interest from EPA's water quality criteria. In order to get the KOC, a generic equation was developed based upon the KOW of the chemical. We know the theoretical underpinning of ESBs are strong. What we do know now, and know very well, is that not all organic carbon in the sediment is the same. There's organic carbon arising from breakdown of plant material, there's from combustion, and from oil sources. And these things have different partitioning properties. When I say partitioning between the carbon and the water. And these things are quite different for depending on the chemical and where you are and what site you're at. And at your sites in general, the KOC values can vary within and across your site dramatically depending on the types of organic carbon that are present. Turns out that ESBs are based upon the diagenic organic carbon, the plant-based materials, and these KOCs tend to be much lower than those for based upon petrogenic and pyrogenic forms of carbon. That's just how it works. With the development of passive sampling now, we can get at, as Rob was indicating, we can measure the free concentration, get at the chemical activity, and again, as I said, bioavailability is equal to the C3 in the pore water. Now, and as Rob pointed out in his summary slides, for this document that we published here, there's two basic elements. You need to be able to measure the C3, and then Rob spent a whole hour talking about passive sampling and how to get at that. The other thing that you really need is the threshold concentrations that delineate acceptable and unacceptable exposure. And the three documents on the bottom here, the one on the left is the document that was published in October. The other two that Rob mentioned there are on passive sampling and methodologies for that. So let's talk a little bit about thresholds for acceptable, unacceptable concentrations. And in the ESB development document, there was a considerable amount of effort devoted to figuring out what should or should not be acceptable thresholds. And after quite a bit of thinking and work, we arrived at selecting final chronic values from EPA's ambient water quality criteria for aquatic life, and then for chemicals that did not have ambient water quality criteria value, we used the Great Lakes Water Quality Initiative method, and those things are called secondary chronic values. In this guidance document that was published in October, we adopted those chronic values as our thresholds as well, and there's a strong basis for that. In EPA's water quality criteria, the final chronic values are derived using toxicity sensitivity sensitivity distributions with benthic and pelagic organisms, and it picks the fifth percentile from the species sensitivity distribution. That's how EPA's ambient water quality criteria are derived. So one of the logical questions that you think about is, well, because we're using mixed species here in the species sensitivity distribution, are benthic organisms, how do they kind of sit relative pelagic organisms? So some comparisons were done, and this is a comparison that came from some of the early work on sediment thinking, and what we have here on the y-axis is the lowest or most sensitive species on the water column, water column species, and on the x-axis we have the most sensitive species on the x-axis, and these are LC50s, and you can see in general they fall on the one-to-one line, suggesting that there's no real different sensitivity between benthic and water column species. Now I show here, just as an example, for endrin, for freshwater species, the species species sensitivity distribution for endrin for freshwater species. And you can see here there's fish, amphibians, and invertebrates. And this is the y-axis is the geometric acute value for the species, and the genus actually, and the x-axis is the rank in fresh, in terms of the species sensitivity distribution. From this, you would derive a final chronic value, acute value of 0.1803 micrograms per liter. Using the acute to chronic ratio, you derive a final chronic value of 0.5805 micrograms per liter. And this is how water quality criteria drive. And we're using that final chronic value if you were going to be doing something for endrin. Now, do I have anything more? Let me see. Okay, moving on to the methodology itself. This methodology follows Superfund's 8-step ecological risk assessment process. And so everyone should be familiar with this process and how it works. And we'll step through this somewhat quickly. As you do in that process, you have a screening OOS, that's 1 and 2, where you determine the nature and level of contamination at your site for the contaminants of concern, and also to figure out what the contaminants of concern are. At this phase, this methodology recommends that you measure the fraction organic carbon, that's FOC, and the bulk concentration for the COCs across the site. Secondly, you would then compute organic normalized concentrations for all the COCs, and then you would compute toxic units for these chemicals. Now, if you have a single toxicant case, the toxic unit is simply the concentration on organic carbon basis divided by its sediment equilibrium sediment benchmark, and that has the same units as the organic carbon normalized basis. For mixtures of toxicants, you would do it for each chemical using its respective equilibrium sediment benchmark, and then you compute the total toxic units. So this is in the first level. You would not do anything really different during problem formulation or in study design the DQO process. And what we say here afterwards in site investigation, we would recommend that you passively sample all surface sediments where the total TUs are greater than 1 and derive C-free and KOC values for those sediments. Now, if you think back, we are using the ESBs as determining the toxic units. They are conservative in terms of the KOC value. So you were using the ESBs as a screening tool here to kind of segregate what samples we should be doing passive sampling on. And I have an example coming that will talk more about that. Then, down in risk characterization, step 7 of the Superfund's process, you would do the baseline ecological risk assessment. And here, You would compute the toxic units using the C3 values that you've measured and the final chronic values for the single toxicant, or for the mixture of toxicants, you do it for each chemical individually and then sum the total toxic units for the mixture. For locations where the total toxic units is less than one, there's little potential risk for these chemicals that you're looking at. Where it's greater than one, of course, there's unacceptable risk, indicating that you should proceed to remedial goal development. Now, in the methodology, we provide three options. You could develop remedial goals based upon the concentration, C3, and the pore water. That's the first one. You could provide remedial goals based upon bulk sediment concentrations, or you could provide it on an organic carbon basis. I'm going to talk briefly about only the middle one here, bulk sediment basis, today, just for lack of time. In terms of developing it on a bulk sediment basis, which is probably how most sites will work, what you would need to do in order to drive your goal, you need to drive a site-specific fraction organic carbon and a site-specific partition coefficient, KOC, for the chemicals of interest. And just for definition, you can see the KOC here is the concentration of bulk sediment divided by the fraction organic carbon by the C3. For a single toxicant case, as we show here in this slide, you can see how you would come up with the pore water goal, where it's just simply the product of the KOC, FOC, and C3, which is set equal to the final chronic value. Moving on to a mixture, you do the same thing on an individual chemical basis and then sum the components. I'm going to step through now an illustrative example, and I'll emphasize this is illustrative to kind of teach and show the thinking. We have a stream segment here. As you can see, the source area is here, and flow is going this way down the stream segment, and the color kind of indicates maybe the concentration of the chemical. And as you would do in the initial part of your site assessment, you would go out and measure the fraction organic carbon. And I have here some hypothetical organic carbon data marching down the river. And for this particular example, we're going to use geldrin as the chemical of interest. Geldrin has an ESB in freshwater of 12 micrograms per gram organic carbon, a final chronic value of 0.06 something or other there, micrograms per liter, and a log KOW of 5.28. The second thing you do in your initial defining the nature and extent, you would measure the concentration of the chemical in the sediment. And in this hypothetical example, you can see here we have values starting at a little bit above 1,000 micrograms per kilogram dry weight and dropping off down to somewhere below 100. And so this kind of the things that you would normally do at a Superfund site. Well, then you would follow up and compute the organic carbon normalized concentration, which is just taking those two previous slides and taking the division of the sediment value by the fraction organic carbon. And that gives you this plot looking here. If you go on and compute your toxic units, that would take the organic carbon normalized value and divide it by the ESB of 12 micrograms per gram organic carbon. And one toxic unit is the dotted line here in this particular graph. And you can see that there's a fair number of samples here that are above the one and a fair number that are below the one. And so I've circled the samples where they're greater than one. And I think I have, yeah. In the methodology, you would go on and passively sample the samples that are circled in the pink ellipse. So if you did that, you'd measure C3 of the sediments, and for grins, I tossed in one point down here because you might want to do that, just make sure that everything's working like you think it should be working. So So here is the passive, the C3 in this particular example. Then you get the KOC from that, from the measurements that you've done. And you can see the KOCs don't vary dramatically here, and the one down here, which is in the, this part of the river here, is not much different from the other ones. And then, as you get down in the risk assessment, step 7, you would compute the toxic units for gelatin using the C3 values and its final chronic value. And you can see now here, there are samples that have little risk. They're below one toxic unit. And there are samples that have unacceptable risk. They're greater than one toxic unit. And so we've used now, it's a two-step process. We use the equilibrium sediment benchmarks as a way to kind of screen what samples do we really need to kind of think about and look at in terms of passive sampling, because that costs money to do this work. And then once we've done that we can then further refine which sediments we should be actually working on. So, as I mentioned previously, you have three goals, three options for developing concentrations for your major goals, for concentration of pore water in the bulk sediment or on an organic carbon basis. And this is a team project thing. We don't tell you how to do it in the guidance. Whatever works for your site and in your group, that's fine. It's not critical. They all have the same basis. So I'm going to focus today on just looking at bulk goals here, and that simply is to come up with a pore water remedial goal is the product of a KOC, the fraction organic carbon, and the C3 value for the pore water remedial goal. So, for dieldrin, in this epidiolectric example, we have a final chronic value of this value here, as you can see. And we could, in concept, compute, and I've done that here in this particular graph here, computed pore water remedial goals based upon each sample down the river. That's sample by sample. And you can see they vary quite a bit depending where you are in this particular hypothetical example. Now, we know, and you all know, that developing remedial goals on a sample by sample basis is probably not realistic. You probably will never have enough data. Pore water sampling is expensive, as we know. Cost some money to do, and so what we're recommending is that you probably will need to develop for your site some type of global average, whatever it is, central tendency for the KOC and the fraction organic carbon. This could be a mean or median, could be upper 95% value, and obviously you probably will need to be defined by your operational unit subareas, depending how things work out at your site. Now, if the variability in these values, KOC and FOC, are low, as we should, it should be very easy to select a single value and move forwards. If it has a lot of variability to it, then some sites may have this, depending on what's there and what the type of contamination, and especially if you have multiple sources of chemicals. And this will require some work, looking at spatial patterns, maybe knowing something about the site history, and you may be able to parse variability based upon that, the distribution values, how you subdivide. So that's going to take some work to come up with these kind of subarea or area values. One of the questions that we kind of wrestled with is how many passive sampling measurements are enough for a site? Clearly, one or two samples is not enough. We know that. We know that measuring bulk and C3 concentrations on all sediment samples is going to be pretty expensive, and because that's doubling the amount of analytical work that you got to do. And there are tools, depending on the variance, using power analysis and those type of things to kind of get a better handle on it. We do address some of that in the document. And we do make the recommendation that you should be just doing the surface sediments. That's where the risk is right now. and not doing multiple cores and going down, and because that just amplifies your analytical costs. Now, when you have a mixture, and most notably pH, is, and I'll show you a little more about that in a minute, you have to use the total toxic. You have to use the toxic units approach. It's the only way to handle those. And I have here from the methodology an example calculation for pHs in pore water. And I know this is a very messy, complicated slide. So I will walk across naphthalene here and kind of explain what the thinking is here. In this column here, we have the bulk concentration that you measure kind of in your screening phase. That would be micrograms per gram dry weight and 3.33. Pulling from the EPA's documents, this is the narcosis final chronic value for naphthalene. We've done pore water sampling here. That value here is micrograms per liter. Using the narcosis value, dividing this value by that value gives the total toxic units for the pore water. And if you sum all the values for all these chemicals down here, you get 58.6 something or other toxic units. If you take the inverse of that, it's 1.704%. So if I take 1.704% of this pore water value here, this is what the pore water has to be pushed down to. And the sum of that would give you the toxic units here of 1, giving you that threshold value. Here's the site-specific KOC that was for this particular sediment sample. And then here's the resulting bulk concentration. And as this concentration actually turns out to be 1.704% of that value. And if you sum all these, it comes out to this value here. And this value here, is where the math works, is 1.704% of this value here. That value, that's how this value is arrived. And so you're going to need a spreadsheet to work with pHs. And the complication, the calculation is not hard, but we do have spreadsheets available that make this calculation pretty straightforward. Now, thinking about mixtures, beyond developing site-specific KOCs and FOCs, we discussed a minute ago, compositions of pHs, for example, do vary across your site. And that's going to be an added complication when working with mixtures. If the variability is low, then it should be not so difficult to select the composition. If the variability is high, it will require some work to determine what's appropriate or not appropriate in terms of composition. This might depend on patterns in the site, patterns in the mixture, site history, distribution values, subdividing the site. I mean, you can kind of, it's kind of a whole mess of things to think about. Now, the last thing I want to talk a little bit about is consistency of sediment toxicity testing results and pore water media goals, because the methodology that was published is designed to protect benthic organisms. And we do have published, and people do use that Superfund site sediment toxicity testing methods, and we do generate that kind of data. So, and as I mentioned in our eyes, sediment toxicity tests are often done with benthic organisms. We want our remedial goals to be protective of benthic organisms, and that's why we're doing this. When consistency exists, we have reasonable assurances that the causes of toxicity are identified, and further that the developed pore water remedial goals will be protective of benthic organisms at the site. So some other background information to think about is that the fifth percentile from EPA's water quality criteria isn't necessarily the same as the test species that you're using in a standard sediment toxicity test. And I've listed here the the genus mean acute values for pH mixtures for a bunch of different sediment testing species, actually six here. And you can see the final chronic value, the final acute value is 9.32. And that is lower than the acute values for these other commonly used testing species. So what happens? I have here some toxicity data for freshwater sediments using Hyalala Azteca, and these are 28-day tests. And I've computed toxicant units using the ESB final chronic value for PAHs. And you can see that survival is low, and then at some point it jumps to being complete death here, no survival. Now, if you notice, the x-axis here is not centered around 1, but centered around somewhere around 18, 25, or something like that. I think it's just a little less than 20 here on this graph. Turns out that, if I go back to the previous slide, IRL are less sensitive than the fifth percentile distribution, and that is why you're seeing the toxic units not centered around round one. If we go on, if we use the water-only testing value for Hyalala, that would be its final chronic value. The values then become centered around one, and the results now are forming a dose response curve that aligns where we expect it should be, around one, and the breakpoint is where it should be. And this is the kind of data that one should see for the kind of toxicity testing data. Now, I can go on. It's not uncommon, because we do see these. We get toxicity data in where you'll see points up. I lost the arrow. Points up here, points down here, with the general distribution looking like this. And you're going, well, what's going on? Well, here, the red triangle suggested to have the wrong toxicant has been identified. There's something not right with that toxicity testing data. Or, if you're here, it's really toxic where it shouldn't be toxic. It suggests presence of other unidentified toxicants. And then, if you think about Superfund site, that's very possible. You could have PAHs in one place. You could have a DDT in another place within your site, just depending on the past history associated with it. And if you start seeing points like this, then you have not demonstrated consistency and remedial goals based upon maybe this chemical here, PAHs, might not be protective, and you have not really demonstrated consistency. To demonstrate the power of this, I've pulled up 28-day survival data from a pile of samples done by Steve Hawthorne from 6 MPG and 2 aluminum smelter sites. And these are PAHs. And you can see these data, I mean, they're from vastly different sites and locations. They all behave like they should behave. They form a nice dose response curve. The break between toxic and non-toxic samples is like it should, and the breakpoint centers pretty close to round one, given all the efforts going on with this particular study. Given that these are totally different sites and totally different locations. Summary: we have a methodology that's been published and it's out there and it's applicable for the protection of benthic organisms from direct toxicity to sediment contaminants, and it's for nonpolar organics, PAHs, chlorinated benzenes, pesticides. And as we have already said a couple times, it's not applicable to things that might accumulate up the food web. It's not applicable to benthic organisms that are higher trophic level, plastic species, and cationic metals and polars. The samplers aren't quite there yet, so it's not applicable there. My final slide here is this is the document. This is the document here. This is its EPA number. If you go get it, you can download it. It's readily available. And personally, Rob and I and others, we're looking for case study sites where we can develop some illustrated real life examples of using this methodology for deriving remedial goals. So, Jean, I'm going to turn it back over to you for question Q&A.
All right. Thank you so much. So, again, I'll remind the audience that Q&A window is available in the lower right corner to submit your questions and comments. I'll start with the questions for Lawrence first, and then as time permits, we may circle back to the outstanding questions that we have for Rob. If you have a new question that you'd like to send in for Rob Burgess, just try to mention that in your question when you send it in that you're directing it to the first presentation. And with that, Lawrence, this first question that came in, I believe this one is directed to you. Are there any plans to update SVCs derived from the GLWQI several decades ago?
Not that I know of, but that's something to add to our list of things to do. And part of that, it really comes from what Office of Water wants to do in terms of their ambient water quality criteria, because these things would need to be consistent with what they're doing. Not a good answer. Sorry, Tom.
All right, thank you. Are there any studies that examine how well pore water predictions correlate with the actual biota chemical concentration?
Can you repeat that?
So they'd like to know if there are any studies that examine how well pore water predictions are correlating with actual biota chemical concentrations.
Yes, there are those such studies. It would take me a while to dig them up.
Okay, all right.
Jean, this is Rob. If I can just interject, you know, some of Dominic DeToro's work over the last 10, 20 years has looked at that question. So the person asking the question, if they did a literature search for Dominic DeToro, they might find some of the answers.
All right, thank you. They also ask, can pore water results be reliably used to explain population level effects?
That is kind of the next step in generation of using pore water measurements that go to higher trophic level species. As I've said, this methodology that we published in October is for protection of benthic organisms living on the sediments. And to go to population level, that's actually two steps. One is getting to pelagic species and then going from that to populations. That's going to take some work, and we're not there yet.
Okay. One of the attendees would like to know, are the spreadsheets that you mentioned for derivation of PWRGs for PAHs available? If so, how can one obtain them?
I have to look, see how to do that.
Okay. And then another participant would like to know, how are background or reference data incorporated into developing PWRGs?
That is a can that Superfund headquarters is struggling with right now. And I'm not the one to be answering that question. It's kind of a policy thing. And I know I'm weaseling on that answer.
That's okay. If it is beyond the scope of today's presentation, that is perfectly okay. We did have another question, and I'll just try to read this as they wrote it in. Is there any concern with actual deployment of PSMs disturbing the pore water and sediments to the point that it is no longer representative of the true pore water concentrations? I think that they are opening this question to either you, Lawrence, or Rob. So perhaps, Lawrence, we'll turn to you and see what your thoughts are first.
Okay, I will respond first. A lot of times when you're doing sediment toxicity work, you will bring a sample from the field to the laboratory and do the sediment toxicity testing, At the same time, you will do pore water measurements. In that particular case, there isn't an issue. I will let Rob kind of talk about field applications.
Thanks, Lawrence. As long as the deployment is sufficiently long that any sort of initial trauma to the sediment has passed, I don't think we're too concerned about the actual taking of deploying the passive sampler causing any alterations of the C-free concentration. Conversely, I mean, if you put the sampler in for a brief time period and recovered it, and then passive sampler and then analyzed the concentrations in the passive sampler and then converted that over to C-free, I think it would be very difficult to interpret your data because the system would be, the contaminants would not have achieved equilibrium with the passive sampler. It's hard to say how you could interpret that data. So the key thing is to do a deployment long enough so that equilibrium can be achieved between the passive sampler and the contaminant. And as I said, any initial disturbance that's done with the passive sampler sediment is long in the past of the deployment period.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm going to start circling back to some of the earlier questions. So, Rob, I'll send these your way first, but Lauren, certainly feel free to chime in if you have something to add. So this participant wants to know is anyone looking at using modified versions for anionic, zwitteronic, and cationic organic compounds, for example, PFAS?
That's a good question, of course, because PFAS is such a big issue right now. It's really still a research topic, and it gets to something Lawrence mentioned at the beginning of his talk, that people are looking at different passive samplers. What I talked about for the non-ionic organic contaminants were POM and PE. Those work really well with those medium to high KOW compounds. As you start to get into compounds that are water soluble and potentially even have some functionality on them, we're going to have to start looking at other polymers or resins to determine if they would be better passive samplers for those other types of contaminants. And as I said, that's still a research question. So people are working on it, but nothing has really been established, nothing has been standardized at this point for those types of chemicals. Other than I should know, because I was focusing on sediments there, there are passive samplers called the POSIS system that can be used for some of the more water-soluble compounds, some of the pharmaceuticals, some of the hormone-type chemicals, generally just the more water-soluble compounds. A key difference, though, with POSIS is it's what we would call an integrated sampler. What it does is it accumulates contaminant over time, and it really never achieves the equilibrium that the equilibrium samplers achieve. And the problem, for lack of a better word, with the integrated samplers is you really can't calculate a quantitative C-free with them. You can get a sort of semi-quantitative C-free value, but it's not a really firm C-free value like you can do for the non-ionic organic contaminants where we equilibrium with the passive sampling polymers.
Okay, thank you. Lawrence, anything you wanted to add to that one?
No, not really, but you start talking about PFAS and those types of chemicals. A lot of them are ions, and they're ionized in water because of their pKa's, and so that presents a whole host of issues in terms of passive sampler design and collection, and we're just not there, as Rob was indicating.
Okay, great. Thank you. One of the participants, Rob, asked, who is responsible for establishing the time series? And I think they were talking to some of those charts that you were showing. What considerations should be made to enhance your selection of the most appropriate time series? For example, risk assessors, RPM, lab, a project team, et cetera.
it's probably a combination of all those people, because, you know, probably for your deployment, ideally you'd want to do it as long as possible, but that can become expensive to do a long-term deployment, and then you also start to run into issues with vandalism at the site. The longer you leave your samplers out, they may get stolen. They may get damaged just by natural conditions. Excuse me. And so it really is a, and this isn't the greatest answer, it really is a case-by-case determination of what you can afford to do and what your site is like in terms of how long you can leave the samplers out. You know, we tend to say at least 30 days, more if possible. And that probably goes back to when we do muscle deployments for biomonitoring, usually go for 28 to 30 days. So there's that kind of analog going. But I think it really is sort of a group decision based on a lot of different variables.
I was going to add, this is Lawrence speaking. If you're doing the passive sampling in the laboratory, you have a lot more flexibility as opposed to if you're doing site deployments, and it's not uncommon to be doing it in the laboratory.
Good point.
Great, thank you. Our next question, are contaminants absorbed through the colloidal phase? Are they available for uptake by benthic organisms?
I can take this one. The scientific literature on colloids and also dissolved organic carbon in terms of contaminants associated with those two phases, VOC and colloids, and this is work done in the 80s and 90s, and what that has shown is that generally those contaminants associated with those phases are not as bioavailable as the truly dissolved concentrations of contaminants. And that gets back to why we're so focused on reconcentration, because that does seem to be a very good surrogate for bioavailable concentration. And I should add, with the test, and this is another beauty of the equilibrium samplers, you know, in the cartoons I was showing, I really simplified things. I didn't show PCBs attached to colloids or dissolved organic carbon in those cartoons. But in actuality, it really doesn't matter, because the contaminants associated with those colloids and with those the DOC, they're also going to achieve equilibrium with the passive over time. So even though you have colloids present and DOC present and maybe a contaminant, if your sampler achieves equilibrium with the contaminants, all those different phases are taken into consideration and you get an accurate measurement of the C3.
Okay, thank you. Another participant would like to know, Rob, if you could comment how to limit fouling in contaminated sediments with NAPL.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's some controversy on this, how to handle that type of data. I'm not sure how you could limit it. Maybe if you put the sampler into some sort of protective casing like you do with SPEME, that would limit NAPL access to the surface of the sampler. That would be helpful with the film or the sheet type passive samplers like PE and POM, because they tend to be a little bit bigger than SPEME fibers. The controversy, what we've recommended is if you recover your passive sampler and there's any evidence that you actually have liquid material contaminant on the sampler, you really need to disregard that sampler, because the partitioning that we assume has the passive sampler may not be happening, because you're actually accumulating on the sampler. Now, another school of thought is, no, it's okay, recover the sampler and wipe that contamination off, and you're good to go, and you know, just go ahead and analyze the sampler. I think that's still an area of research as to what to do in that situation, and we probably do need some studies looking at that question to see if when you actually have NAPL on the surface of the sampler, does it create artifacts, or can you just wait?
Okay, and so the last question that I see in the queue, and again, Rob, I'll away. What advantages do passive sampling devices have over collecting pore water directly for analysis?
I think it goes to those artifacts. When you collect pore water directly, you're just risking the uncertainties associated with loss of the dissolved of the C-free contaminant to the surface in the labware that you're using, as well as the potential that you do get colloids in your sample. And when you have colloids in a conventional pore water sample, it's different than when you have colloids present during a passive sampling event. When you have colloids present in a conventional sample, you take that pore water, you extract it with solvents. Those contaminants that were associated with the colloids are now going to become part of the organic extract that you analyze or maybe expose in a toxicity test in some way. And that's going to result in an overestimation of the C-free or the bioavailability of the contaminants in that pore water. So that's a problematic artifact that can occur. And also, as I said, with the passive sampling, with conventional pore water sampling, it can be quite expensive to extract and isolate enough pore water to do a toxicity test or do a chemical analysis.
Okay, great. It looks like we've reached the end of the questions that have come in online. I think one or two of you have reported an issue with the online feedback form, so I will talk about that in our closing reminders here in a moment. I just wanted to turn to Lawrence and see if there were any final reminders or thoughts he wants to leave the audience with.
No, but just thank you for attending. And it's not hard to find my email address. So.
Thank you. And Rob, any final thoughts you'd like to leave the audience with?
I think same thing as Lawrence. Just thank people for their attention over the last couple hours. And if you need to contact us, you have our email, so please go ahead. So thank you.
All right. Thank you so very much, gentlemen. With that, let me go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders before we go ahead and close out today's live broadcast. I want to thank those of you who took time out of your busy schedules to join us for today's live broadcast. We did have 150 individuals who signed on for today's live broadcast, so thank you so very much. If you'd like to find out about future webinars like this as soon as they become available, I strongly encourage you either visit the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org or sign up for our free monthly electronic newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month. So you're welcome to visit us at Cluin and add your name to our mailing distribution list. As I noted at the beginning of today's presentation, copies of the materials that our presenters used, as well as links to a number of the references or papers that they talked about, are included on the seminar resources or links page. You'll find that on the middle right of your screen under the related links or URLs box. If you scroll through there, simply click the link that's the seminar resources and then press the Browse To button to actually open up those websites on your own computer so you can access those materials. Contact information for both of our presenters, as well as myself, can be found on the seminar homepage. And if you could take just a brief moment and fill out our online feedback form. A few of you have noted that there seems to be a hyperlink issue with the form. I have found that error myself. We are working to fix that right now. So if you give me about 15 minutes, we should have the feedback form corrected. So I'll ask you to just hang tight, and we will email everyone as soon as that feedback form has been fixed. But just to give you a bit of a preview of why we ask for those feedback forms to be completed, we do depend on feedback from our attendees to continue to offer free online internet seminars like this. I read each and every one of the submissions, so please, 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 once we get that form up and working, take a moment to let us know what you thought of the content, both the way we delivered it as well as the material that was covered. If you are looking for a participation certificate, you'll get one of those as soon as you submit your feedback for today's broadcast. So when you fill out that form, as soon as we get it up and functional, there's a box you can check at the very bottom of the form, which certifies you are here for the entire session. As long as you check out that box and completely enter your email address correctly, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can either download or print out for your own records. While we do not issue PDHs or CEUs for our webinars, oftentimes our participants are able to get credit for attending with their own accrediting institutions by saving these certificates and copies of the materials or the seminar homepage sort of overview with their own, again, institutions. If you happen to participate in a group under someone else's registration, each of you can actually fill out that feedback form even if you didn't register individually and get your own participation certificate. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the link to the feedback form, which will hopefully be fixed by the time you're replaying this broadcast, and fill out the feedback form based off of your replay of the archived version. Again, it takes us about 1 week or so to get that recorded version available for on-demand playback, so I encourage you to not only keep your eyes open for the email when the archive is available, but again, in about 15 minutes, I should have the seminar feedback form functional, and I will email everyone who attended today's webinar just to let you know that it's okay to go back in and give us your feedback for today's session. I apologize for any inconvenience that causes, but thanks to those of you who reported it to us in real time. So with that, that is the formal set of reminders that we have to end today's session. I want to thank everyone for joining us today, as well as our presenters who helped put together today's presentation and